One, two, three, four. Just another day at my dead-end profession. I'm living day to day. Yeah, listening to some good old country records on the radio. And yeah, what else can I say?
All right, time for another show. I'm Ryan. That's Dave and Bobby.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. This week, I have... I've walked away from that gig that I was having a lot of fun with, the wrestling announcing for Fist Combat.
Now, was it because that you were afraid you were going to get called out in some kind of wrestling-type fashion?
They were going to write him into a story.
Yeah. You got a chair match with Mikey Gordon.
They were going to put me at the Spanish announcer's table, and I had a big problem with that. No, I liked doing it, but it was very hard. All right? It's tough work. You're fucking, like... It's just kind of like emceeing any show. You're on all night,
right?
But you're not really one of the featured performers, you know?
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
All the work, none of the glory.
It's a lot of work, and like unlike comedy, you had to really fucking put your voice into that thing.
Right.
And you guys know I already have voice problems.
Yeah.
So just all night, like, hailing from Death Valley, California, weighing at 221 pounds. Like, just that all night.
Right.
So anyways, but I was sticking with it because I really like Mikey. I still really like Mikey. We had him on this show. But the thing is... I did not know this going in. Lots of the wrestlers really looked down on the dude doing the announcing, you know? I mean, they treated me a little... Some of those guys treated me like shit. Like, I'd be like... I'd have to chase them around and get their credits beforehand. Like, yeah, what do you want me to say about you? Just like, you know, any host. And, dude, these guys were like... Would just, like, look down their noses at me, man. Like, a lot of them. Not all of them. Some of them were really cool.
I like the idea that the guy who's wrestling in a bar in San Diego for a little bit of cash, getting a bunch of staples put in his back, looks at Ryan. He's like, oh, what, you talking a microphone? Fucking idiot.
Seriously, and that's the way it was. And so one of the wrestlers, like, I was, like, emailing everyone, like, in a group message, like, hey, everyone, I really need your credits before next Saturday or whatever it was. And the dude said the equivalent of, like, go get your fucking shine box to Joe Pesci. He was like, it was one of those things where, all right, it's already really hard. I'm getting less money than I do from stand-up, which that's not Mikey's fault. Mikey gives you all he can. Those shows, like, barely make a profit. So he's giving me everything he can, so I can't really ask for more. But I'm like, dude, it's hard. I'm not getting paid a lot. I'm like, fuck this, man. So I walked away, but not before calling that wrestler a stupid cunt, because I did.
This sounds like the beginning of a great grudge match.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Like, you should have gone through with it.
Yeah.
And, like, when you're announcing that guy's match, you sneak in with a chair, hit him over the head with a chair, fucking...
Well, I was thinking a lot more along the lines of an MMA match. Now, hear me out.
Okay.
The thing is, I think what the problem is a lot of these pro wrestlers, and if I'm wrong, please let me know, any people working in the wrestling biz, I think some of them start to believe their own fucking character a lot, and maybe...
I really am a dead guy.
Yeah, no, I really think this guy, because I had met this guy before, and he was nice to me, and we had a nice talk, and I really liked him, and then he's like very much in character, only it was private, so I don't know why he'd be fucking in character, starts being a douchebag to me, who's trying to make him look good, by the way. That's another thing. You're being a dick to the guy whose only job it is to make you look fucking good.
All right, first of all, he doesn't need you to make him look good, all right? He looks fucking great.
Yeah, it was like the last straw, but I wanted to remind him, you're not actually a tough guy in real life. You're talking to the only person in here who actually did fight competitively. So, like, I think I would like an MMA fight with this guy just to fucking expose him.
That would actually be pretty funny to have, like, a bit or a series where, like, pro wrestlers or guys who are in the wrestling circuit, like, get into actual fights and, like, their moves, like, don't work in real life.
Well, here's the thing, though. Just like MMA, when it first started and you would have guys who were jiu-jitsu guys fight guys who were boxing guys or wrestlers, you would have to let him use his method of fighting choice. So he gets to come in with a staple gun and a metal chair.
I'm good with that. I will take that shit away from him in about 2 seconds.
You can't use it, though.
I won't
use
it.
That's not part of your MMA.
No. But a nice Kimura will get him to drop a chair real fucking quick. Let's see how good he is to the stable gun in a goddamn Americana. Anyway, so I still love that promotion. If you liked going to Fist Combat, still go. It's still a great time, and I might go back to it in a few months, but for the time being, I am no longer with that promotion. You know what also would be really good about having like an MMA fight coming up? It'd be finally the motivation I need to get in like fucking tremendous shape again.
That's true.
Right, yeah.
That's
because
true.
I think it was when I finally gave up on ever being able to go pro, and I knew it wasn't going to happen. Before that, when I really wanted to go pro, I was in the best shape of my life because I knew in my head, if I was not,
yep,
I could get killed.
Yes. Right.
Very literally.
It is the greatest motivation because you can be in all the shape you want. You could even have an athletic endeavor. I want to go play basketball or something. And that's very motivating to you, undoubtedly. There's a difference, and I had the same thing, because I was a very, very unathletic boxer. I'm the least athletic person you've ever known in your life. I wanted to be a boxer, so I tried really, really hard, and the only advantage I could give myself, I wasn't more athletic, I wasn't more talented, I wasn't more skilled, but I could run. And if I could just run forever, I could...
I'm picturing Bobby running from his opponent.
Yeah, right?
Running in circles.
Just going around. I could run and I could work on tactical skills. But every mile I ran, I knew I'm putting gas in my tank. I'm increasing my gas tank, and that gives me a chance.
Like, yeah.
I'm not going to necessarily dominate this guy, but if I can drag him into the last round, I have the advantage at the end there, and that's where I'm going to shine.
Some of the best fighters on Earth, the chink in their armor was they get gassed. Yeah. Look at Conor McGregor. He's got terrible fucking stamina.
Well, one of the problems is if you're very talented, if you're not like me and you're an incredibly talented fighter and very athletic and whatnot, you don't necessarily
need that.
You're so used to running dudes over that it doesn't matter. And there is a difference when you are training scared, as I called it. Yeah. I was training scared. I knew I was going to go in there with a bunch of killers who could kick my ass. And the only advantage I could have is if I went out and did 10 miles a day every day and really got that gas tank going. It's a whole different type of motivation.
And fighters fucking hate cardio. They're scared of it.
Yeah.
Like most of the guys I trained with that were actual pros, if they were going to a fight for a title, which was 5 rounds instead of 3, they'd always be saying, I'm not letting this go to the 5th round. I do not want to do cardio. I just do not
it's
make
like,
me breathe
like
hard.
It's like shitty free throws in the NBA. It's like they just don't want to work at it. They don't want to practice. They don't want
to. Yeah. Well, I mean, here's the thing. Like I remember it very clearly. When I was training to be a fighter, I had this voice in my head. I had this incredible drive. And the voice would always say, "No." After 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, which was my regimen at the time, it, like at the 5th hour, my voice would be going, "Never fucking quit. Do not fucking quit.
Yeah.
That is unacceptable to quit." Now, I was on the elliptical the other day, and that voice has changed.
Yeah.
Now that voice is like, "Dude, this sucks." It's fucking hot. Is it hot? It's hot.
Let's go bang my hot wife. Come on, let's go do it. Let's go.
Dude, didn't you just hook up a new keg at Carl Strauss in that kegerator? What are you drinking right there? Water? Gross. That probably has backwash in it. Let's just fucking get out of here. That's seriously the voice now.
Yeah, it's like, "Hey, have you heard of Non Pizza? It's real good. Maybe we should go there."
Dude, they have Fox News on the TV. Let's just go.
Yeah, it's like the first voice was Bruce Buffer, and the second voice is like AM late night radio.
Yeah. So my voice sucks now. I don't know. I think maybe having an MMA fight would just would really motivate me again, or maybe not.
Well, I'm the same way as you guys. Like, I feel like this is normal now. Like, I don't do anything unless there's pressure.
Yeah,
a deadline of pressure, and there's no more pressure than like some guys trying to knock you out.
Yeah,
like okay,
oh yeah, that's a lot of pressure.
And by the way, not just some guys trying to knock you out, because that's what people think. They think, "Oh, you're gonna get hurt. You're afraid of that." There's also some guy's gonna knock me out in front of close to 800 people. That is a huge motivating factor.
In front of your woman.
Yep. As much as you think to yourself, "Oh, I don't care what people think. I don't care." Get in a ring where a bunch of people watch you get your ass beat, you'll fucking start caring.
Yeah. And I don't care how progressive you are or how non-alpha, non-ego guy you are. If you get handled in front of your girlfriend, your primal instincts will resurface pretty quick. I don't care what kind of evolved human you think you are. Yeah, getting beat up in front of your fucking girlfriend is not fun.
I've told that story. That's actually the what gave me the confidence to do stand-up. I wasn't necessarily very comfortable doing public speaking, but my sophomore year when I really sucked at boxing, I went in against the guy who ended up winning the national championship, and he beat the living fuck out of me in my hometown in Berkeley, in front of my friends, in front of my girlfriend, in front of everybody. He just smashed me so bad my coach had to throw the towel in the third round. And I came out, I was busted up. It was the worst beating I'd ever gotten. The only time I ever actually bled in the ring. Just the worst beating I'd ever gotten. I was demolished and embarrassed, and everybody around me is embarrassed. And nobody knows what to say to you, by the way, because they don't know to come up and be like, "Oh, sorry."
Yeah.
There's
after
no redeeming.
That, he hooked up with your girlfriend. He poured shit in your gas tank.
It wasn't one of those situations where they're like, "Hey, man, you got your licks in." It was like, You hit him that time.
I can't believe you don't have to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so there's nothing. Everybody kind of sulks away and gets out of the place. And then you're super embarrassed because you have to go see those people. And your girlfriend, my girlfriend was literally crying in the stands as he's beating the shit out of me. And I thought afterwards, I thought, well, wow, this is.
Was she crying because she was worried or because she was so embarrassed that she's your girlfriend?
Yeah, right. A little bit of both. I thought. Well, A, it hurts, but that's not really what you care about in the moment because you're used to being hurt from training and stuff. That's not a big deal. You're like, this physically hurts, but also this is insanely embarrassing. And then when I wanted to do stand-up, people were like, I don't know. It seems, what if you don't do well and stuff? And I'm like, I thought to myself, well, that would be embarrassing, but the worst they can do is laugh at me. At least nobody's beating the fuck out of me, too.
Yeah.
And so that is how I was like, ah, fuck it, I'll go do stand-up.
Yeah. No, I remember one time, one of the only girlfriends that ever saw me in any type of competition was I did a pancrase tournament in 2007, and my girlfriend went, and pancrase, for those of you who don't know.
It's where you fight insulin.
It's not...
I was going to make the joke that like now he's not training, he's in pancake tournaments.
Yeah. That was actually better than I thought it would be. No, it's not quite MMA. It's like grappling with like open-hand strikes. Striking. And it's actually, there's like different rules depending on which tournament you're in.
It's actually the origin of not only MMA, but most people don't know this. It's actually the origin of Eastern martial arts. It started in Greece during the Olympics around 0 AD. And basically that ends up getting exported to the East and becomes all the traditional Eastern martial arts, karate, all the other stuff, all come from a pancrase origin in like the, I don't know, like 10 BC. Or something.
And that's also where you got a lot of like faker martial art guys that think that like try and impress people by saying the strongest strike was an open-handed strike to the face. No, a punch hurts worse.
It is, but here is the advantage to an open-hand strike. If you are not wearing gloves, you're not going to break your hand. The big thing about open-hand strikes, and it's one of the reasons Boss Rutten loved them, a lot of the old MMA guys loved them, you can throw full power with no gloves on and not break your hand. So if you are in a street fight type situation, open-hand strikes are actually really powerful. And if you're Boss Rutten knocked out a lot of dudes with palm strikes.
So anyways, I was in a pancrase tournament, and because it's not like MMA, you're not taking actual punches. Like we did multiple, it's a tournament style all in one day. You fight multiple rounds, and I won the first three and lost in the finals. And even though I had beat the shit out of the first three guys I faced that day, because I got caught in a fucking triangle choke at the end, she was like kind of embarrassed. And
listen, you didn't see that triangle coming? Come on, it's kind of amateur.
Yeah, I know. She
who gets caught in a triangle?
She
nowadays?
Was more focused on the one loss than the three wins earlier that day. Like, that guy really handled you. I'm
it's like if you're doing comedy and you crush for 10 minutes and you close your tanks and people are like, ooh, man, you suck.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much it. I felt terrible. Like, she was like, oh, you're not very good at this. Anyway, Bobby, any follow-up to last week where you were talking about that hack-ass scientist?
Yes. Thank you so much for bringing this up. You guys remember I was talking about the Cerruti Mastodon site, about how I went to their to a presentation.
No, I don't remember that.
And
Bobby hit him with an open hand strike.
Yeah, it was legal
in front of his girlfriend.
It was legal. And then I kind of asked him questions, and he didn't have some answers. And then he said I could come look at his artifacts, and he hadn't called me back. He has called me back. We have set up an appointment. I will go
to duel
to personally investigate those supposed artifacts. I will go and see if this is legitimate, and we will confirm or deny whether or not that national story is true. And
I don't have to MC another debate, do I? Yeah. I can't go through that again.
What are you MCing?
What do you have on the books for this guy? What's gonna?
What do you mean?
What are you guys gonna do?
Oh, so I'm gonna go to the Natural Pistols. History Museum. I'm gonna go check out the supposed stone tools he has and the supposed bone artifacts he has, and see if they are true. Because what he is claiming is they are way older than any kind of hominid.
He's got a hammer from Home Depot covered in stucco. Yeah.
As far as the follow-up on this, I'm a little skeptical as far as this will happen because I don't recall if you ever did the follow-up from the Flat Earth debates.
I did. We did a little bit, actually. If you remember, if you guys were listening to the Flat Earth debates earlier, because we got a question about this from one of the listeners.
Actually, yeah, we have some listener questions. You know what, Dave? That is in our listener questions. Let's actually get to those.
Yeah.
Let me see who it's from here. So, Alex in San Diego. A follow-up in the Flat Earth debate. Did Bobby ever go to the Sunset Cliffs experiment? Right.
So we did go out. We ended up going to La Jolla. I took Daniel out. If you guys don't remember,
of course you did. Hit him a car.
We did a debate with the flat Earth debate guy who really believes in the flat Earth.
I don't really think he does. By the way,
he does. He absolutely does. 110%. We had.
I'm picturing this like a date. Also, like it was kind of like him a date. Up,
I did pick
flowers.
Him up. Yeah, it was nice.
Did you buy him lunch? I bet you bought him lunch.
Not that time. We had the debate. It was about whether or not the Earth was flat. One of the things I mentioned was that you can see differential sunrises based on height. So if you lay on your stomach at the beach and you watch the sunrise, you can pop up real quick and still see the sun again because it's going below the horizon. He thinks it's going beyond your
further
field
away.
Of vision. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. That was my entire thought process the whole time. Like, even if you show him that works, he'll just say, no, it's because it's farther away.
But it's not farther away in that sense. So, like,
doesn't matter. That's his thought process.
Well, no,
not
it,
convince
it does matter
otherwise.
Because if you remember the debate, I set up the scenario beforehand and said, do you agree to all these conditions? And he said, yes. And I said, do you agree if this happens, then that would show your conditions are false? And he said, yes. So we did go to the beach to check it out. Unfortunately, it was an overcast day. We didn't really get a good sample, but...
So that proves that the Earth is flat.
I will say this. I have hung out with him a few times since then. I'm still working on him. I think there's a good
You
heart.
Know he made fun of the shooting victims from Las Vegas, right? Like, openly.
He's a homophobe, right?
There's a good heart underneath...
No, there's not.
He's got some... There's clearly some cognitive issues, and that's fine. And
that's a nice way of saying he's a fucking moron.
Yeah, I feel like he's bad at his core, and you're finding little pieces of good, like, on top of that.
He's like one of those, like, accidentally does something not horrible once in a while, and Bobby fucking hoists that up.
Well, here's the thing that I always think about with people. Like, you know, when you're talking to him, if you watch the video of the Flat Earth debate, I don't need to emphasize this anymore in terms of what cognitively is going on there. But at some point... You're making fun of the person with Down syndrome for not doing well in calculus. Like, at some point, there is a mental issue that's keeping him from understanding what's going on and functioning in the world normally, and he has a distorted view of those things. And so maybe the better option is to try and find a way to
address... So you're advocating eugenics. Okay,
I'm not saying kill him. I'm saying let's address the issue in a way that works around that particular mental issue, and then maybe we can help him kind of... come to allow that good.
No, I don't want anything to do with them. Anyway, so so I put up a prompt online for listener questions, which I always dread doing, by the way, because inevitably, for every one really good question...
Most of our friends are comics, and people try...
Not even friends, just fucking strangers trying to be funny. This is the one thing where... No one's ever been funny when they tried to be. Like, not even close. Like, let me read you some of the joke responses when I said, does anyone have a question for the Degenerate Podcast? Let me read some joke ones here. Men's G-spots are in their butts. Disgust.
It's true. Go find them.
Yeah. So we got some good ones. First one comes from AJ in, forgive me if I say this wrong, Flowfurious, Texas?
Sounds made up.
Yeah. That's not a place. What's the biggest celebrity you've met, and were they what you imagined they'd be like?
Now, real quick, like, if we were to flip the script on this, if we were trying to give stupid, what we thought were funny answers, you'd be like, biggest celebrity I ever met? Andre the Giant.
But you've never met Andre the Giant. So.
He doesn't know that.
All right, Bobby, you go first.
Oh, geez. See, I have some nerd answers to that. My big
no
nerd,
shit.
My big nerd ones would be like Tim White, who's like basically the biggest paleoanthropologist ever.
You met Tim White?
Yeah, I was actually a student of Tim White's. And then also probably Craig Venter, who is basically the Albert Einstein of our generation.
Can you do like a normal answer?
Yeah, can
something
you just,
that
just,
anyone can relate to?
Just say fucking Bill Burr and move on.
Let's see. Oh, Aaron Rodgers, I guess. Aaron Rodgers and Alex Smith, the two quarterbacks, two starting quarterbacks, one for the Packers and one for the Chiefs. I grew up with Alex Smith. He was a childhood friend. And then Aaron Rodgers, I went to college with, overlapped 1 year. I met him briefly at a party, and he was very nice.
Nice. That's awesome.
Were they like you expected?
So Alex, again, he was a childhood friend, so I didn't know he was going to go on to be one of the, you know, a starting quarterback for 12 years in the NFL.
The other one?
Yeah, and Alex, by the way, super nice, not only super nice guy, incredibly intelligent, AP classes, gate classes. The kid graduated college in like 2.5 years and then went on and started getting a master's degree in like the remaining year before he went off to the NFL. So he's an awesome dude. And Rodgers, for a guy who was tearing it up and one of the best quarterbacks in college at the time and then became probably one of the greatest quarterbacks in the NFL of all time, super nice, humble dude. I remember I was just a stupid freshman at one of his parties, and I accidentally sat in his chair. Like, it was a party at his house, and I went and sat in his recliner. And
was he Archie Bunker? Who has a chair that early in life?
Well, he was literally like sitting in it, talking to a bunch of people. He got up to go get a drink, and stupid freshman Bobby walked in and was like, "Oh, look, an open chair!" And
shuffle your feet, lose your seat, thing.
That's college rules, man.
Yeah. Not when you're the starting quarterback, one of the best starting quarterbacks on earth.
You were the captain of the boxing team.
Not at the not at the time.
No, chess team back then, man. Better get up and fucking move.
I was a freshman. I wasn't even a member of the boxing team yet. And anyway, long story short, yes, very nice guys. It's always nice when you meet people who are actually decent human beings.
Dave, what about you?
I've met a few. I did meet Bill Burr, now that you mentioned it. And it was super cool because it was after a show. And I was, I know a friend of ours, Jason Lawhead, is friends with Bill Burr. And so he got me in the back room. We were chatting. And he was just like talking to both of us about a joke he tried on stage. Like, what do you think? Do you think that? It was just weird to see him like a normal comic, like questioning his material.
Yeah.
But probably the two favorites of mine. I've met Henry Rollins a shit ton of times just because.
Really? I've never met. I've seen him live 4 or 5 times, never gotten to meet him. Where do you go? Do you
like... learned very early on that he will stay after his show and meet anyone who wants to meet him. Every time I saw him, I would stay and I'd meet him.
Damn.
Hold on, I just got a text from Rollins. Stop blowing me up, Callens.
But he's like you would expect. He's kind of gruff. He's a little bit of an asshole. He's a little surly, but he's also a nice guy, and he's smart, and he's fun to talk to. And if he's like interested in talking to you, he'll chat for a while.
I can never get the picture out of my head of him raping Katie Sagal in Sons of Anarchy. That will always be what I think of.
He was wearing a mask when that happened. How do you even have that image in your head?
He had the tattoo!
Never saw it. But my favorite one is I met Olivia Munn a few times. I met her from hanging out at Comic-Con.
That's right. That's the name you always drop.
Olivia Munn. That's my celebrity friend.
Yeah.
Like, she's super cool. Like, we'd go to Comic-Con, me and a bunch of guys that knew her, that got to know her through Comic-Con. Like, one year she took us all to a movie. One year she took us out for dessert. She's too big now. She doesn't, you know, we can't see her, but it was cool to hang out with her.
At least 250.
She can't even have to knock down a wall in her house.
How weird is it that your celebrity and my celebrity were a couple?
Oh, yeah, right?
Yeah, Aaron Rodgers and Olivia Munn. Okay.
Mine would be one night I opened for Sarah Silverman at the Improv, and when I was there, this is two in one night. It was a very bizarre evening. I think the Giants were in the playoffs. And at the bar, that was on the TV. It's the bar at the Improv in Hollywood's outside, or at least it was before they remodeled it. So they usually put the games on out there because it's not going to bother anyone in the showroom. And what's his name? Kevin Pollak was sitting at the bar watching the Giants game. And for no reason whatsoever, he just turned in his seat and just started staring at me without saying a word. Like, just directly at my cheek. I was sitting next to him, and he just like was looking at me like I was the TV for a second. So my manager at the time, James Cross, was sitting up to my right, and I kind of leaned over. I'm like, "Is Kevin Pollak staring at me?" He's like, "Yes." And I'm like, "Is he still staring at me?" He's like, "Yeah, he hasn't stopped. I don't know what the fuck's going on here." He didn't say a word, and it was all I could do to be like, "What, Kevin Pollak? What do you want? What do you want me to say? You were great in House Arrest? Leave me alone."
I would have had to throw a line of his from Usual Suspects at him. Just
I couldn't quote one if I tried.
Did you ever figure out why he was staring at you?
No.
That would have bothered me for the rest of my life.
You think it doesn't?
It still bothers him.
So that same night.
Why didn't you ask? I don't understand why you're blowing by this. Why did you go up and say, "Hey, Kevin Pollak, how are you doing? My name's Ryan. Can we talk about why you're looking at me?"
I should. Hindsight's 20/20, Bobby. So anyway, that.
He sat in Kevin Pollak's chair. That was the problem. That was his chair at the bar.
So that night, I did really well ahead of Sarah Silverman. I just assumed she'd seen me. And I was really excited. So afterwards, she was out front. I was having a cigarette. She came out. The audience was still applauding for her. And I was like, "Hey." And she went, "Hope you enjoyed the show." I'm like, "You did not even know I'm your opening comic, do you?" So that was kind of heartbreaking.
She's one that I'd love to meet her, but I always hope that she'd be as cool as I want her to be.
She was nice. I mean, yeah, she just didn't know.
I'm kind of afraid to meet her.
You don't want it to like ruin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I got you. That's how I feel about Corolla. I'm afraid he'll say something really shitty and it'll hurt my feelings.
100%.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I was hoping your celebrity encounter story was going to be like Kevin Spacey or something like that, but you can dream.
No, I've not met him. Next one comes from Alan in Hemet, California.
Sorry, Alan.
How do I get out of Hemet?
Yeah, exactly. How can I get out of here?
What are prices like in Murrieta? What advice do you give to a first-time host? Okay. Ooh. I assume you mean of a comedy show and not just having people over at your house.
Yeah, parties. Don't run out of beer.
let me take this one first. Number one, move it the fuck along. There are so many people that like to stretch out their little hosting segments in between each person. And another thing, So do your 8 or 10 minutes off the top, whatever it is. But in the middle, the only reason why you should be doing any like lots of material in between comics is if the last guy bombed and you're trying to get him back for the next guy. That's the only reason.
And
if the,
even then, keep it short. Quick
keep
one
it
line.
Short. Just get him. Yeah. But if the guy right before that just finished has crushed, say as few words as possible. Keep that right. momentum going for the next time. Do not get up there and be like, I think I want to absorb a little of this. Fucking be like, oh my God, give it up for Zoltan. All right, next guy is Dave Gallins. So, that fucking keep it short. What do you guys think? Anything to add to that?
I love hosting. I think hosting is one of my favorite parts of doing comedy because you get to kind of interact with the audience a lot. It helps you work on your crowd work. I love doing it for the Kumite for a long time. A couple of things. One is, like you guys said, keep it short in between. There are two instances where you don't want to do that. One is you mentioned, which is the guy bombed and you have to bring the crowd back up. The other one happens much more rarely, but is still something that is your job as a host, which is hecklers. So if you have a heckler who's killing one of your guys, you got to come up in the between. You do enough time so that heckler starts talking to you and you go after them so that the other comics don't. Because it's not their job.
Yeah.
Secondarily, yes, move it along. Have some good quick one-liners. When you open the show, and I've made this mistake enough times that I know it, if the crowd is halfway decent, you don't want to spend a lot of time up there, but get them loose and open. Work some decent crowd work. Get them to like you. Because every time you introduce somebody to the stage, you're essentially giving them credit. Hey, this is this guy I know and I like. You want the crowd to like you. They don't need to think you're the funniest guy on the show. They shouldn't think you're the funniest guy on the show. They should think the headliner is. They should like you so that when you introduce somebody, they already have a positive view of that person. And then lastly, and this is one that I fucked up the other week at Kumite, know the person's name. You need to know their fucking name, how to pronounce it right. I actually went up because I love Miles. Miles is a great San Diego comedian. I'm actually a big fan of his. I went to go, he was at the Kumite, and I couldn't hear him. I was like, Miles, how do you pronounce your fucking last name? I've seen your name written 1,000 times. I don't know how to pronounce it. And I couldn't hear him saying it. And then I just went up and I was like, Miles, I don't know, something Mexican.
Mega ding dong.
Yeah. And that was totally unprofessional. And I actually sent him a message afterwards. I was like, hey, sorry about that. But if you are going to be a good host, know the name. And then also find a way, and this is also rare, but it happens every once in a while. Find a way to cut a guy off who's running the light.
Okay.
You have to have a pre-plan of how to cut this guy off because somebody will run the light. Eventually they will. That's screwing over the next guy in line. It is nobody else's job except yours to stop that as the host.
I can see that.
Right. So have something where you come up, like you sneak up on stage and you have a prepared joke or you have something where you can push that guy out.
Put him in a rear naked choke.
Yeah.
Something. Yeah, those. No, that's all good. Keep it moving is most important. Don't do time in between. Yep. Very important.
Yep.
But you have to be ready constantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, yeah.
You are the busiest person there. Some comics,
that's why I hate doing it.
But some comics will bail early.
Yes.
You have to be ready.
You can't be in
you
the green room.
You have to know everyone's name and credits because you got to be ready to go at a moment's notice.
Be at the wings the entire time. There's nothing worse than when, like, for instance.
You are busy all night.
And that's not really the comic's fault. Like, for me, I was just doing a pop-in spot at the Madhouse of like a month ago. And Dave, you remember this because you were there. My second to last joke just got fucking on fire, like applause. And I'm like, fuck it, I'm ending right there.
Yeah.
That's a good move. I'm like, yeah, I'm done. Thank you.
Yeah.
And the host, thinking I was going to do another joke, had to fucking sprint like hurdle over a fucking railing.
Yeah. Not only that, but you should be paying attention because here's another good tip, which is, when you go up in between, you can do prepared one-liners or little bits or little
you
material.
Shouldn't.
But, you should do one thing to make the audience giggle or whatever. But regardless, the easiest way to do that is to listen to the set of the person that just went up and
reference
make
something.
A joke that was on that set. Because that lets the rest of the audience know, hey, we're all in this together.
Right.
I heard the same set you did. Maybe we saw him do something silly. Maybe he tripped on the way up. Whatever it is, let's experience this together. This isn't just some prepared stuff that I've had sitting around. This is real and in real time. That will do much better. So if you throw out a joke like that about that other comic set, that's a 7, that'll do as well as a prepared 8.
Yeah,
or
I'm like you. I love hosting. I think it's great. Too many comics, I think, hate hosting. They don't want to do it.
Me.
But it's like it's high-intensity training. You're going up cold. If you can go up cold and get the audience to laugh at your jokes, that's worth so many more sets than going up in the middle of a hot show where they're already warmed up.
That's a really good point. And then also you have to think that on any given show, depending on how many comedians are going up and their skill and their talent and the audience, somebody's not going to do well. if you're just a comedian going up to do a set, you have a 50-50 chance that, probably better than 50-50, that the audience is primed and ready for you. They've laughed at somebody else. If you're a host, you have almost 100% chance that at least one of the times you go up, the guy just bombed,
yeah,
right? Because you go up in between every single person. You have to learn how to salvage a bad audience really fast if you're a host.
I'm sick of these guys that do like way too much time up front hosting, then do time in between.
Hostlining.
Yeah, it's fucking horrible. I'm sick of it. It's a trend. I hope
five up the top, a minute in between. That's a good rule.
Yeah. All right. Next one comes from Mike. Oh, it's our buddy Mike Castleberry in San Diego here. If you could do one thing differently in comedy, what would it be and why?
Oh, I would have a catchphrase to start with.
What would Dave Callen's catchphrase be?
I'm going to kill myself later.
It's just at the it's his tag at the end of every joke.
I haven't been happy since 2008. That's a good one.
Oh, that's so good.
All right, Bobby.
Jeez, I've been really lucky in comedy. I've had a lot of advantages.
That's debatable.
I guess there's always the thing where when you start out, you overestimate your abilities. You always think that the bringer shows you do are representative of other things. That's always a bad news. But I don't necessarily regret doing those shows because they helped me get to other places that I needed to be in. I would say this, the one thing that I did well that I'm glad I didn't mess up, and I see a lot of people messing up, don't burn your fucking bridges.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many
people. Wow, yeah, that's a good one.
There's so many people. I was smart enough to know coming in, I had this kind of fraternity mentality coming in, which is I'm the low man on the totem pole. I understand my position. I'm going to sit quietly and observe. I'm not going to talk shit to guys who are above me. That helped me a lot because I saw a lot of other people who started around the same time as I did who were very, very talented, and they ended up burning so many bridges that they never got the show.
Well, you know what that is that, you know, you're around so many raisin cakes when you start out the open mics, you know?
Yeah.
So if you're actually decent at comedy when you start out, everyone's going to be in awe of you at the open mic level because they're so bad at it. And the thing is, when that happens, when you have a big group of people that are saying you're good, even though your talent is just starting out there, it's very easy to get in your head and think you're Conor McGregor.
Happens all the time.
And you can be a loudmouth and you can throw your weight around. And you know what? I was a little bit guilty of it early on too. I was like, oh, well, this group of people thinks I'm really good. And as soon as somebody said something I didn't like, I was the first to mouth off. And I made an ass of myself. So mine would be, though, I would have chosen to make some partnerships early on with people that were as ambitious as I was. Because I've mentioned this before on this show, and I just talked about this on Alan Henderson's podcast I was just a guest on called Thank God It's Over. Check that out. Early on, I chose to make friends and partnerships in comedy with guys that I just liked as a person that I thought were cool.
Right.
A bunch of East Coast guys that like I thought were funny on stage and I could drink beers with afterwards. And, you know, it's not okay to make friends with people like that.
Right.
But I would have also partnered with some people that I thought, you know, really wanted to make it. Because I just assumed when I started that we all were ambitious. I thought
Bobby,
that.
Is he firing us right now?
I think so.
He's bringing in two other people.
Come on in, fellas. Bobby, you don't even live here anymore.
Get out of here, Alan Henderson.
So anyways, like, for instance, I just thought the goal for everyone doing comedy was to someday be a big star. I just thought that. Other guys were pairing up with people that, you know, were working as hard as they were. So, you know, when they were booking their friends on shows, they were booking them back, and they both had these, you know, they're pushing each other. Like, look at Bijan and Jesse Egan,
right.
You know? Those are two guys, they're super ambitious and help each other out.
Yeah.
My friends liked girl chasing and beer drinking.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd be like, oh, guys, I booked us on some shows. Like, cool, we might get some chicks while we're up there. Yeah. And then I'll be like, did you guys book anything? Like, fuck no. I don't give a shit. This is a hobby to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, when they finally washed out and none of them are doing comedy anymore, I was kind of like,
they got a bunch of chicks and beer.
Yeah.
I was alone. So when you're starting out, I would say look for people and question what their ambitions are in comedy and make friends with them and make partnerships with them. Think about more than just, I like this guy. He's fun to have a few beers with.
That's really good advice. Yeah. Find somebody who pushes you. It doesn't even have to be somebody who's, you know, ahead of you. I started with my old friend, Damian Mercado. We started at the same time. And he is somebody who's like that. He helps push me. He helps get me to do things that I otherwise would be lazy and not do. And it gives you a level of accountability. There's somebody else out there who's like, hey, bro, why aren't we at this mic? Hey, bud, why haven't we done a show in two months? Hey, guys, we need to get this podcast off the ground. You need to have that person. And even if you're that person, because I'm that person too, you need somebody else so that you can't just kind of slack off one day and be like, eh, fuck it, who's going to care? You need that other person who cares.
Yeah, that pretty much addresses what I would do differently, because December 3rd, 2006 is when I first told Joke. I'm 11 years in this month. Yeah. 11 years. And I'm like, I should be way better than I am. Because I didn't hustle very much. Yeah. Like, I didn't hustle. When I first started, my first 2 years, all I would do is the open mic at the store. Once a week, open mic at the store. And not even enough. Every week, you know, sometimes.
Yeah.
And guys, you know, a lot of comics have low self-esteem. I'm no different in that regard. So people, like, after a while, I get to know people. They'd offer me, hey, come do this spot. Come. I'm like, nah. Like, I didn't think I was good enough. I didn't want to go to a different place.
So you got in your own way a little bit.
Yeah, so I didn't hustle, and I still don't. And, like, I think, I look back on that, like, if I had hustled a lot harder, I would be so much further ahead than I am right now.
Here's a good one from, let's see, Beth in Boise, Idaho. I'm a nurse, and you've mentioned you worked in lots of different healthcare departments. Which was the worst and why? All right, so there's two that come to mind, Beth. And I was what's called a float, which means I would fill in at different departments. I worked for the organization, but I'd go where I was needed. So that's why I worked in all these places. And the second worst was the Owens Clinic, which is for AIDS. And I don't know what it is about AIDS, but a lot of insane people have it. And I showed up to this clinic, and it was the only one I'd ever shown up to where there was bulletproof glass at the checkout station or the check-in station. And I'm like, yeah, that's where you'll be sitting. And I'm like, so why do we need this glass? And the guy just points and goes, that's why. I turn, and there's a guy looking at me, licking the glass. He's just licking the glass, and they're like, yeah, you need to check him in for his appointment.
And Ryan's like, can we at least not have the glass flavored? I mean,
and then later that day, he's like, all right, so the 4 o'clock patient, you need to check him for knives. I'm like, why? He's like, because the last four times he's been in here, he's pulled a knife on the doctor, so I just got to check him for knives. So, and then give him back to him because, you know, he should have those. So, no, but that was the second worst. The worst one was the Moores Cancer Center in San Diego. And it's not for the reasons you'd think.
Which is that he hates people with cancer.
Cancer kids are gross. Just die already. You're taking up all my attention. So anyways, that was hard for two reasons. Number one was when people are losing family members to cancer, they're not rational. They will not accept no for an answer. And understandably, when you have to tell them no on something like, well, we don't have an appointment right now, you know, or what, or we don't have your prescription ready, they in their head are like, you're giving their loved one cancer.
Right.
You're causing this.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of potential for people to lose their fucking minds on me all the time. And when your loved one is dying from cancer, also understandably, you don't realize that everyone else in this clinic is also dying from cancer.
You're
the only one. Tunnel vision. So there was that. The other part of it was I didn't so much feel the worst for the person actually that had the cancer. It's their loved ones around them. Because I'm like, this person's going to be out of here.
Yep.
And you guys are just going to carry that pain with you for years beyond this.
And likely a lot of medical bills.
Oh, yeah. For one thing, you guys know this. My mom died of cancer when I was 7.
Yeah.
And when I saw a kid with his mom who was also 7.
Oh, yeah.
I remember having this thought. I was like, shit, man, you don't know what is about to happen. I know you don't because I've been where you are. I'm like, when she goes, and dude, I seen her chart, she's going to go. I'm like, you're going to maybe have a fascination with death, and people might call you weird because you don't have that dynamic, and people will say, oh, you're obsessed with death, but that's not the case. And, you know, you might even think that life is temporary for everyone you meet for a while. You think that everyone's just here for a second, and you might not have empathy growing up for people that lose people because you had to deal with it so often. So you might grow up to be a very weird kid, and you don't even know it yet.
Yeah.
So those things would affect me.
It would be hard to see the kids. That would be super hard.
So yeah, that one was really tough. Let's see, next one, unless you guys worked in the healthcare field, want to answer. Oh, this is a good one. This is kind of a dual answer. This came through Facebook from our good buddy Paige Wesley in LA,
right on, Paige.
My buddy from college, Rich.
Listen to Cult Podcast.
Yep, that's a good show. So from Los Angeles, what joke do you love that never works? And then Rich asks, conversely, what's your least favorite joke that you still do that almost always works? That's a good. I know my least that my most favorite joke that never worked, even though I really wanted to. I'm like, this is the best thing you've ever written.
And before you guys say all of them,
yeah, it was that nightmares are awesome and good dreams suck, because when you have a nightmare, you feel lucky to wake up and you feel blessed to be in your normal life.
Okay.
You wake up even in your shittiest of apartments, you can wake up and be like, oh, thank God I'm not getting chased through a swamp by a giant Hot Pocket with a clown face or whatever you fucking dreamed of. But, like, when you have a great dream that you won the lottery and your wife said, hey, you can bang the neighbor's wife too, I don't care, and all your problems are solved, you wake up and go, ah, back to my shitty fucking life.
That's a good bit.
I know, and no, it never got a laugh. Never.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'm like, when you go from living in a mansion to waking up and having to go to a cubicle in your real life, do you realize when that happens to people in real life, they kill themselves?
Dude, that's because it's too real. Like, I've woken up sad so many times because I'm like, oh, God, that was just a dream.
Yeah, back to it.
Too real.
Yeah.
Mine, the one that never works, always comes after a specific comedian. His name is Brian Street Team, and he is an ex-porn star, a good friend of ours. And
he's been on the show.
Yeah. And so he frequently talks about what's called a blow bang in the porn industry, which is like a gang bang, but you get blown instead. And,
I'm watching one right now.
And I have brought up, I always come up after him, and I bring up how insane this is, and you have to realize how dumb porn stars are, that they've named this thing a blow bang. A gang bang is a gang of guys banging a chick. This isn't a blow bang, it's a gang blow. And it doesn't make any the only reason is that porn stars.
All right, Bobby,
are so
enough.
Dumb.
All right, that's enough.
He's
they've come
so,
up with this.
He's so mad.
I'm this so angry at this.
He's
and it's
so fired
nobody,
up.
Nobody gets it. Nobody follows me here.
Because like, it's not that big of a deal. It's just, oh, they chose the wrong
how
name.
How stupid
okay,
are you?
Joke?
You come up with a name that doesn't make any sense for what's going on. You just saw another word. You threw one of the words in there without even thinking about what it means. And that's now the title of this fucking thing. No! No, you can't calm me down!
All right.
I've got a bunch of jokes and tags that like don't hit the way I want them to, but one that sticks in my mind is I talk about what it was like growing up without the internet versus how it is now, how easy it is now.
Yeah.
I've heard other comics use this reference in their bits. The old, I think it was Cosby came up with this, like, walking to school 5 miles uphill both ways
right.
or 10 feet of snow. I've heard other comics use that to sort of set a tone, and they get laughs, and I use that in my bit, and it just never hits. And I'm like,
really?
On paper... it should work.
Yeah.
I've heard other comics use that reference in a similar way,
yeah.
but for some reason it just never hits when I do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what's the joke that you have that, like, it always got laughs, but you're like, why are you even laughing at this? I think mine was that joke where I test if the deaf guy in the trolley is really deaf by jumping.
But
I'm like, this is so fucking bullshit. I tormented a handicapped person. You people are laughing. Stop laughing.
I mean, I have an intro bit that I use sometimes that does better than I think it should because it's kind of a cheap joke, which is that the show will be very diverse and we believe in diversity because we don't see any differences between human beings, which is why I've been punching a lot of mouthy chicks at bars and fucking a lot of dudes. That one gets a good laugh. It's my equality joke.
God. So, all right, so that's a good one. Last one here. This comes from Dan. He wants to know what our thoughts on Kratom are. Now, if you remember, we had an advocate for Kratom on this show about a year or two ago, Maestro Richie T, and he came on, and you know what? So Kratom, for those of you who don't know, it's a natural drug or something.
Yeah, so it's a plant. Bobby, it's a plant that whose substance mimics some of the effects of an opiate, but it itself is not an opiate. It's native to Southeast Asia, and it is in this weird quasi-gray legal area right now where you can get it, but they want to stop you from being able to get it, and there's a back and forth. After we had him on the show, I actually went and did some research, and it's more dangerous than we have put out. It is not quite an opiate, but it can do some damage, and there have been some overdose issues, and people have died, and blah, 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 blah. It's one of those things where you're like, man, if you're using it to get off opium, I get it. If you have a heroin addiction and you're using Kratom and that's what's going on, absolutely. It's like my methadone argument. It's the lesser of two evils. If you're just a regular person who's starting out and wants to try some of that, man, I'd do the same thing I do with any opiate, which is like, you got to be fucking careful. Like, those are the type of opiates ruin people's lives. And one of the problems with Kratom is that a lot of people will start it. Then after a while, they kind of want the next level and then they go up to opiates.
I took it, man. I tried it. I didn't feel a thing.
Really?
I got kind of cloudy vision.
Okay.
I took like, I did it once and my friend who's an advocate for it is like, oh, you didn't take enough. So I took like seven.
Wow.
And I'm like, I just feel cloudy and I don't feel good or bad. I'm like, all right. But like you said, people are using it to get off opiates,
right.
You know? And dude, I'm not a conspiracy guy. You know that. Like, anytime there's a conspiracy guy, I'm like, they usually have a flexibility of schedule.
Right. That's true.
They're usually not really with it, dudes. But by the way, if all conspiracies are true and learning about the truth turns you into like the unfuckable loser most of these guys are, I'd rather live in the dark.
Right.
But anyway, I'm not a conspiracy guy, but when they fucking made Kratom illegal, I was like, dude, something's up. Here's this thing that's getting people off of opiates. And by the way, that's another thing working in the healthcare field. It blew my mind what this country's going through with opiates, like with prescription pills.
You were the biggest drug dealer in the world. That's what the medical industry is.
Really? And the thing is, before I worked in the medical industry, the only exposure I had to addicts were, you know, like living in the Sandpiper Motel when I was 18 and seeing the tweakers or Ocean Beach, you know, the guys without shoes wearing a fucking trash bag as a coat. Like, those were the drug addicts. When I started working in the medical field and I'd see the people, like the pill seekers, like, dude, these are lawyers. These are fucking housewives. These are people we know and love. And they don't even know they're addicts. Because why? This isn't drugs.
It's in a bottle.
This is my medicine.
Yeah.
This is my And so what if the bottle says take one a day and I'm taking seven? The doctor gave it to me. That makes it okay. Right. I have permission from the God of our society to take this and thus abuse it if I want to. Because it's like, you know, when you were a kid and your dad says, if you want to have a beer, you're it's okay if you have a beer until you have four, you know? This whole country is sinking due to fucking opiate addiction. And here's this thing that came along that could maybe curb it just a little bit. And fucking someone went, no.
See, if the numbers back that up, I would be there. We don't have them yet. We don't have those numbers because it's such a new influx of this particular
But that's
stuff.
The thing. Let's get the numbers.
Right. But the numbers could also be that a lot of people, because we do know that some percentage of people start out with something like Kratom. And then when it doesn't work as much anymore, they move up to opiates because it's a very similar high.
Oh.
And so that is my main concern. If it does more good than harm, then absolutely put it out there. But the thing is, whenever it comes to two drugs, opiates or meth, I'm always like, fucking be careful, man. Like, those are life enders. Those aren't cocaine. Those aren't weed. Those aren't ecstasy. Those are the things that people fucking throw their life away on.
Yeah.
And so anytime there's anything around that, I'm always like, maybe that might be something we shouldn't make illegal.
Yeah.
Knowing much less than either you do about Kratom, like, I'm going to side with Shores because, like, it's not even just a conspiracy theory. It's fucking corporate.
Yeah.
Corporate greed.
Yeah. Like, it's less of a conspiracy. That's right. It's just more money. Like an unfair thing
it's
they
some
did.
Some companies that are making a shit ton of money off this see something that can like cut into their profits. And, no, get rid of that.
Yeah.
See, I don't think that's the case because the group that makes it illegal is the DEA. It does it under some pretty fucked up laws and stuff. But basically, they do that even with things that have no corporate interest. You know, I mean, LSD does not have a corporate interest. Psilocybin does not have a corporate interest. There's no corporate interest
so
fighting it. And yet they're still illegal. They're illegal because of a different mindset. I don't think it's necessarily a corporate thing. I think there is a mindset, especially in drug enforcement,
that's because you're not woke as fuck.
That comes from the 1970s that says all drugs are bad.
Right.
These are bad. We need to get rid of them. If it's illegal, it is bad. Booze is fine, blah, blah, blah. But if it's illegal, it is bad and we need to kill it. And that's why marijuana is horrible and blah, blah, blah. I think it's a different authoritarian mindset that has to do with we can't let these people get certain drugs, less than the corporate thing, because the corporate thing isn't even necessary. Like, we have this group of people who hate drugs and they're going to make it illegal.
You know what's speaking of that kind of thing is, you know, this net neutrality thing that's starting right now,
right?
Which, as I understand it, It's like the presidency is going to put parental controls on the internet. Isn't that basically what it is?
They're trying to dismantle net neutrality, and it's even bigger than that because it would basically allow your ISP, your internet service provider, to dictate where you went, when you went, whether or not you were able to see certain things, bill you more for going to certain things. So let's say you had AT&T was your internet provider, and they team up with Time Warner. So now it's AT&T and Time Warner, and now they don't want Netflix to be popular because Netflix is obviously killing the cable industry.
Right.
So they just say you can't go to Netflix anymore.
Yeah, that's
the thing. Or they'll slow it down.
Yeah, they'll slow it down, or they'll say you have to pay extra money or something. They can do the same thing with Amazon. Let's say you were a competitor with Amazon. You want to come out with a new product placement thing that has an open marketplace store. All you do is you get involved with one of the Time Warner AT&T type conglomerates. You just say, hey, can't go to Amazon anymore.
You know what? one thing as this bill gets proposed, I think Trump's about to see how many right-wing Christian moral guys are not going to be in favor of their free porn being taken away.
I don't think they have that much foresight to consider that.
That's true.
The porn one would be big too. There's a lot of push to be able to. That's one of the ways you regulate.
Forget
porn.
Bitcoin. Buy a bunch of porn DVDs right now because the free stuff's about to be illegal.
Dude, I have one friend in all of my Facebook friends, one guy out of like 1,600, who is like for the repealing of net neutrality.
Really?
Yeah, because he thinks it's going to create a competitive marketplace and make everything cheaper and everything faster.
What? What's going on right now? What is uncompetitive about the internet right now?
Yeah.
Who stops somebody from competing on the internet?
It's going to create a monopoly. By the way, you mentioned cable companies. Is it me or are they the only ones exempt from monopolies? Like, I feel like I move into an area, it's like, ew, Time Warner sucks. Like, that's all you're allowed to have. Like, really? I can't hit? Nope. You cannot have anything but that.
Up.
I'm like, fuck this. And they wonder why cable companies suck. All right, before we go, a couple chances to see us do some live comedy. You can see me on Thursday, December 14th in San Marcos. I'll be at the Inland Tavern. December 19th, I'm doing the Madhouse Comedy Club in downtown San Diego. And December 31st, I am at the Consulate Hotel here in San Diego. That's going to be a New Year's show. I'll be going on around 9 o'clock, and then I'm going to get the fuck out of there. And the big show is going to be, you can see me and Dave at it, possibly Bobby if I get him to host it, is the Burning Beard Brewery here in La Mesa. We are doing a big show for them on January 10th. And January 20th, I will be at the Salty Frog in Imperial Beach. All right, you guys got any dates?
I'm going to be at the Madhouse the Friday and Saturday before Christmas. It's going to be a fun weekend.
Okay. Bobby.
No, but I am working.
Boo!
I am working on a show that will be debuting in June at Nerd Night. I'll announce the exact dates and where you can get tickets, and that'll be part of a new show that I'm doing called The Science of Comedy.
All right. Well, on that note, I'm Ryan for Dave and Bobby saying see you next week, cruising with the twos.
That would have bothered me for the rest of my life!
You think it doesn't? Yeah, time passing by. Oh, yeah, time passing by. Oh, motherfucking time is passing by.